Recording in progress.
I'll call this meeting to order of the Atascadero City Council, and I'll ask Councilmember Bourbeau to lead us in a pledge to the flag.
Please join me in.
Meeting to order of the. Thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Here.
Councilmember Darris?
Here.
Councilmember Funk?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom?
Here.
Mayor Moreno?
Here.
All present.
Thank you. Well, whether you are attending here with us in person, and we have a few more people this meeting as people are getting used to the in-person, or if you're on the webinar tonight or on the phone, we welcome you. If you are on the phone or if you're watching maybe on Channel 20, listening on KPRL, if you'd like to call in during community forum or any public comment on any of the items that we have, you can dial 805-538-2888. When you call, please let us know which item you'd like to be speaking on. And again, that number is 805-538-2888. Can I get a motion to approve the agenda?
So move.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Councilmember Bourbeau and a second by Mayor Pro Tem Newsom. We will waive the reading in full of all ordinances appearing on this agenda, and the titles of the ordinances will be read aloud by the city clerk at the first reading after the motion and before the city council votes. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. I do see our city attorney has popped on the line. We reported out last time, so I don't think anything needed to be said tonight. Is that correct?
Well, just in case it does, there's no reportable action.
Okay, there's no reportable action. Always good to reaffirm that. Thank you very much. We have no presentations this evening, so we'll move on to the consent calendar. Our consent calendar contains items that are considered to be routine and non-controversial by city staff, and they can be approved in one motion unless there is a member of the council or the public wishing to pull an item. So I will look to my council members and see if there's anyone wishing to pull an item. Seeing none, I'll look to the public. Any member of the public wishing to pull an item? If you're on the webinar and wishing to do so, please raise your hand, or on the phone, press star 9. Luke, I'm not seeing anyone in the webinar. How about the phone? No. All right. We'll close that up and bring it back for a motion.
I'll move approval of the consent calendar.
I'll second.
Motion by Councilmember Bourbeau, second by Councilmember Funk. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am. Thank
motion
you.
Motion passes.
Next is our updates from the city manager. Ms. Rickard.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. The first thing I want to talk about tonight is that our recreation team helped the district earn a state award. So the California Parks and Recreation Society, CPRS, recently held their annual conference in Sacramento. Two of our recreation staff members, Jennifer Fanning and Larice Lopez, attended that conference representing the city of Atascadero as they currently serve on the local CPRS District 8 Board of Directors, with Jennifer as the board's president. Late in 2021, the District 8 board organized and hosted an in-person fall forum for local recreation professionals. And this year, District 8 was only one of two districts recognized by the CPRS board receiving honors for their fall forum. So congratulations to Jen, Larice, and the rest of District 8 board for their hard work and statewide recognition. While we're talking recreation, let's talk about Monster Skate. So the Monster Skate series is back. Yay! The first contest of the 2022 Spring Series is at A-Town Park this Saturday, March 26th. Registration for all of the Monster Skate contests being held throughout the county begin at 9 a.m. And so for more information, go to ccmonsterskate.com. It's a great event. I know we're excited to have it back after the COVID hiatus. We also have our spring concert series. So we're kicking off our new spring concert series to be held here at the Sunken Gardens in downtown Atascadero. These live concerts will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on the first four Saturdays in April, beginning April 2nd and running through April 23rd. The four-week band lineup starts with Burning James All-Stars on April 2nd, then Carbon City Lights, Back Bay Betty, and finishing up with Soul Effect on April 23rd. That's a very nice band lineup, lots of fun for all of those. All of our concerts are free to attend, and afterward, concert guests can always stroll through the downtown and enjoy some great wining, dining, and shopping, or maybe go to Galaxy Theater, enjoy a round of golf at Mr. Putt-Putt's. They end at 6, perfect time to enjoy our spring evenings here in Atascadero. And one of my favorite events is coming up, so Brew at the Zoo in 2022. Mark your calendars now. Brew at the Zoo is back and in person. We did hold Brew at the Zoo very popularly virtually during COVID, but this is even better having it here in person. It will be held on Saturday, April 30th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. Tickets are on sale now at great early bird price of $35 per person through March 31st. So hurry up and get those if you want to get the early bird special. As of April 1st, the prices go up to $40, and the event is always great fun with live music, games, dance contests, a variety of craft breweries, cideries, wineries, together with over 200 exotic animals in the zoo. And tickets can be purchased at www.my805tix.com. If you have questions, you can either go to the Charles Paddock Zoo website or visit Atascadero, as always. So, great event. I encourage people to sign up early. There are a limited number of tickets, and it's always very popular. Beautiful evening at the zoo. And one last final reminder, if you like your beer, we have the Central Coast Craft Beer Fest. The Craft Beer Fest is this coming Saturday from noon to 4 p.m. here at the Sunken Gardens. And there'll be plenty of great craft breweries, wineries, and cideries, live entertainment, food trucks, and a variety of vendors and games, in addition to being right here in our downtown where you can enjoy your shopping and eating and dining and all the great activities we have here. So for more information about our events, you can always go to www.visitatascadero.com. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions council may have.
I'm going to say Deputy City Manager Terry Banish did not skip a beat coming out of COVID. So she has got us right back going, and I know our residents are really happy with all the activities we have. I see we have a question maybe by Council Member Darris.
Yes, thank you. On the beer fest in the garden, yes. Is there that looks to be free to the public to just to attend, or is it?
It is not.
Okay, because there was no tickets on the.
Yes. Go to www.atascadero.org. I am not positive that they have remaining tickets.
Okay.
So if you're interested in going to that, go quickly.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
See, not even special timing or tickets for council members were. We snooze, we lose, just like everyone else. All right, thank you very much. We're on to community forum, and this is the portion of our meeting that is reserved for persons wishing to address the council on any item that is not on our agenda this evening, but over which the council has jurisdiction. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes, and we allow a total of 30 minutes for community forum. We ask that you would state your name for the record, and know that anything brought up tonight will not become a discussion among council members at this evening's meeting. So with that, we will have the timer going for you, and if you are here in person, go ahead and get lined up if you plan to speak, and then I will go to the webinar where you can raise your hand or the phone where you can press *9. And with that, welcome to our first speaker.
Richard Moen, Atascadero here. I have a quick question for our office manager real quick. Do we have a sandwich board ordinance prohibiting them in the downtown section of Atascadero?
So, well, if you can ask your questions and we'll answer everything afterwards. We don't do a back and forth during community forum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you want to know about sandwich boards. We'll write that down. Okay.
My comment would be if she could answer it. If we have one, enforce it. If we don't have one, enforce it if we have one.
Okay.
Okay. The second one is I'd like to talk a little bit about our pigeon poop entry into downtown Atascadero. In other words, traffic waste, some people call it.
If you could come a little closer to the mic, we want to make sure we get you.
Okay.
There you go.
Is that better?
Yes, thank you, Mr.
Do I need to start again?
No, you're good.
Okay. I brought this up at a city council meeting probably 3-4 years ago about the unsightliness of all the pigeons underneath our freeway and the traffic way El Camino, and I think something needs to be done about that. Should have been done after I spoke 3-4 years ago. Someone said it was Caltrans's responsibility. Well, we surely have topics with Caltrans that we could talk about that. And then the ones over the side, the light standards over the sidewalks, that's unsightly. It is ugly. And that's our quote-unquote entryway to the downtown. My third quick comment is, I know that the city is always looking for ways to bring tourism to our city and get their tax dollars. I think they used to call it leakage years ago, how much money was leaving Atascadero. We could stop leakage without the tourism if we had a place to shop in Atascadero. We have no shopping. Besides, boutiques are rather expensive. And that's nice. We lost Kmart, 2 years ago, so we don't have even a moderate price store. So I think, you know, we could be looking into more things that would service our own community before we worry about bringing people into the community that are here and they're gone. The last thing is, and this is a real late thank you for, I don't know if you were on the city council, who was on the city council at the time, but I also spoke years ago about the intersection of San Anselmo, the overpass, the terrible job that the potholes that you had to dodge all the time. And I wanted to thank the city council and our public works department that they did a great job of fixing that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next speaker.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Bruce Gibson, the 2nd District Supervisor for the County of San Luis Obispo, now proud to represent the City of Atascadero. And I'm here tonight, first, to introduce myself to those of you who may not know me. I'd also like to report on a couple of actions that the Board of Supervisors took last week that might be of particular interest to your constituents. And then, lastly, to be sure that you know, both as council and as residents of the city, that I am available to you on any matter that you think I could be of assistance with. So let me go rewind. A week ago today, the Board of Supervisors had an item to allocate ARPA funds, American Rescue Plan Act. You may remember that the county as an entity got $55 million. Within the distributions there, we put $3 million into a pot to help our small businesses and $3 million into a pot to advance child care. And we made allocations out of both of those. Out of the small business category, we did allocate $500,000 to $100,000 to each of the 5 districts. And those are... That money is aimed to be grants toward small businesses up to $5,000 for a business that has up to 10 employees and up to $10,000 for businesses up to 25 employees. We're in the outreach phase now. Applications are going to open on April 1st and run through the month of April. And I encourage anybody who has felt the effects of COVID is looking for a little bit of a hand up as we move into whatever comes next to contact the county. And if you're having trouble finding that link, please contact my office. I'm particularly excited about the child care allocations, and we're putting $3 million into the hands of a consortium that's led by the County Office of Education, along with the Child Care Planning Council and the Child Care Resource Center, First 5, which I'm proud to serve on. We are looking to reinvigorate child care. We've lost child care, and we were down much less than we needed when we started. We're looking to enhance child care, build new facilities, and reinvigorate the workforce. And I think you all know how important childcare is. The folks who provide the care are paid way less than they deserve, barely over minimum wage. And we hope that we can build an extremely strong system in this county because we know it's good for the children, it's good for their families, and it is quite possibly the strongest economic development tool that we can exercise here as a public agency. So I would again urge any folks who have interest in that and your council or and or your residents to contact me, and I would look forward to working with them to get you connected with the right folks. And again, on any other matters, I am available and look forward to serving you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next speaker.
Good evening. I'm Gordon Fugley, a Atascadero resident. I am an art historian and organizer of art exhibitions for many years. I started my career as an intern at the J. Paul Getty Museum many, many years ago. I'm very proud to tell the City Council and our community of a very important accomplishment that I had the honor to be part of, and that is an anthology by seven scholars. Here it is. It's going to appear in the bookstores and on Amazon in early June. It is the first comprehensive treatment of the late 20th century, early 20th century architecture of California and of its architects that defined our built environment, including Walter Bliss, who designed our Beaux-Arts City Hall, and of course, Julia Morgan, who the architect of Hearst Castle and the Monday Club down in San Luis Obispo. I want to give special thanks to Terry Banish, because she helped us obtain important photographs to illustrate our definitive anthology. There we are. And our lovely interior. So there is a kind of synchronous, what is it, a harmonious coincidence or whatever it's called, a synchronicity. My colleague in Los Osos is Victoria Kastner, and just this month, her biography of Julia Morgan, it's titled Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect, has also appeared. So what are the odds of two major publications coming out of one county on an overlapping subject? So I hope that people will enjoy these historical scholarly publications. And thanks to Terry Banish again for getting the photos.
Close, right?
Thank you.
Ready? I won't. Ready?
Is that a... Oh, right. I think, Chief, if I could ask you to mute yourself. I think we're hearing
there you.
You.
Come All on. Right. Line up.
Or maybe Luke could mute the chief. There we go. All right. Next speaker.
That's a hard act to follow. Hi, I'm Jeff Oslin. I am a resident of Atascadero for about, on and off, for 25, 30 years. I have two businesses here in Atascadero, and I'm also now running for District 2 County Supervisor, and I'll make one clarification right now that Mr. Gibson, Supervisor Gibson, may be representing Atascadero right now, but so is Debbie Arnold. She is still a supervisor for two more years for Atascadero. Now, moving forward, the reason I'm here tonight is a few folks in the downtown have contacted me regarding parking. I brought this up before. I'm going to bring it up again. I'm hoping that as we do El Camino and setting that off with parking down the middle and making it into one lanes, we consider what we're doing in the downtown, and maybe we do that ahead of time. I think we need three or four pickup zones in our downtown. We have restaurants. We have boutiques in our downtown, and parking is very hard. We do have a parking problem. We have a flourishing city now with a lot of business citywide, but we're bringing a lot of people to our downtown. And when you go out to eat, we need a pickup spot to be able to grab food to go or run in to a clothing shop or wherever it might be, the typewriter shop, and pick up what you need and go. And maybe 15, 20-minute parking in the downtown is now appropriate. So I'm hoping that we can start looking into that. On another note, and this is more for our planning department, I had another resident ask about the old Kmart. And as we're searching to do different businesses in town, we are lacking things for our youth in this town. And maybe we could be doing some outreach to see if it's feasible to put in perhaps a skating rink or an ice skating rink and a bowling alley again. So thank you, Council. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no one else in the chambers wishing to speak. I'm going to go to... Let's see, any attendees on the webinar, you can simply press the raise hand icon at the bottom of your screen if you would like to speak, or if you're on the phone, star 9. I'm not seeing anyone on the phone, and I'm not currently seeing anyone on the webinar. So with that, I will go ahead and close our community forum and bring that back to council and staff. Regarding Mr. Millen's comments or questions with regard to the sandwich board, I know we have an ordinance, and maybe it's not something we want to get into tonight, but if you feel you could briefly answer that.
Yes, the city does have a sandwich board ordinance. Sandwich boards are not allowed on the public sidewalks. They are allowed on private property still, but there are some rules in place. We are currently, like a lot of places, a little short-staffed right now, and so code enforcement is a challenge, but we're currently recruiting, so if you are interested in being a code enforcement officer, please come to our website and look under the jobs postings, and we'd love to have you apply.
Yes, you heard it here first. Apply.
That was a great segue.
It really was. We're always looking for, we're always on the ball when we see somebody who can fill a position. And, you know, honestly, with regards to leakage, you know, yes, it is a problem that we are well aware of, and something that the council has worked on diligently for the last several years. COVID certainly put a little bit of a halt on that, but we are continuing to move forward. I do encourage our residents, as many of you already do, to support the businesses that are here. Sometimes there's this thought that build it and they will come, but I think we all have to come to the businesses that are here, and then more people will build as they see the momentum in the business that is here and the need and the desire that's here. Some of the other questions, staff, if you want to get with Mr. Mullen on the pigeons and the freeway and that kind of thing. Mr. Gibson, thank you for letting us know about the ARPA funds. I spoke with Rochelle Bolle the other day. She was thrilled with the child care, so she's really excited, as I know others are, with what the county's doing. And Mr. Fugley, he left. That was amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And with regards to the downtown parking, that's something that Mr. Oslin brought up. We will certainly be looking at as we look at the downtown situation. And, a lot of things on our plate. So thank you all for coming out this evening. Community forum, let's see. I've got to get my notes in order here. Since we have no one else that's wanting to speak at this time, we will keep community forum open until 6:43 p.m., so that's about another 11-ish minutes. And at this time, we're going to move on to our next item. But if you decide that you'd like to speak on public comment, go ahead. If you're in the chambers, if you're on the webinar, raise your hand on the phone, let us know, and we will get to you at the next earliest opportunity, which will be, you know, between our after we're finished with the agenda item that we're currently working on. And at that, we have no public hearings this evening. We'll move on to our management reports, of which we have three. The first is a contract award for our general plan update project, phases 2 through 6. I will ask our community development director, Mr. Phil Densmore, for the report.
Thank you, Mayor. And I'm going to actually hand this over to Lorelei, and she's going to tell you all about the general plan contract. I'm going to weigh in a little bit as well. But this was definitely our most substantial and exciting project in many years. And we also will have our general plan consultant on the line this evening as well.
Good evening, everybody. Excited to be here this evening to present our general plan update project. We are bringing before you phases 2 through 6 of this contract. Just to refresh your memory, we were here in December, on December 14th, discussing phase 1 of this project. The existing general plan was adopted in 2002, and we came before you in late December to talk about beginning this process. It's about a 2-year process that will basically help us envision our community through 2045, including looking at our vision and our values, reviewing past policies and understanding if those are still correct and right for us and the direction we're going, or if we'd like to refine those. And of course, really talking a little bit more back in January about what we'd like included in this update process moving forward. There's a lot of things have happened, a lot of economic shifts have occurred, and a lot of fiscal conversation that needs to happen as far as where are we going, what do we need to be sustainable as a community. In January, we had a scoping meeting with our consultant, MIG Consulting, which we entered into contract with. They helped us go through a process of looking at our assets, our challenges, our opportunities, and we did a lot of brainstorming, so you might see some of this as familiar from our workshop session. It was a very long day of economic development and general plan scoping. So we have actually put together a scope for the rest of the phases, phases 2 through 6, which include a preferred approach to public outreach, a level of analysis as far as CEQA and a lot of these other conversations we'll have tonight, areas of focus that were important to council members and decision makers, desired elements, and final deliverable. The final total budget, as proposed to you tonight, includes $1,115,273. And now I'm going to walk through basically the 6 phases, and you can ask questions along the way. We also have our consultant, Laura Stetson from MIG here, available to answer questions this evening. Luke, if you want to bring her over to presenter mode, she can help and jump in, or we can just save questions till later. So I'll walk you through. Phase 1, we are about 80% through. We kicked off, again, right after our Phase 1 contract was awarded on December 14th. The process included a kickoff meeting and a citywide tour with our decision makers and department heads. We walked through, basically prepared an entire briefing book that we presented to you in January 28th when we had our study session. There we talked about our scoping meeting, what we wanted to include in our community involvement strategy and other elements. And then the rest of their work will be updating this general plan update work program based on your input tonight. So phase 2 comes to $305,000, roughly. This phase is basically gathering data and input. It's technical analysis to build the foundation for our general plan. This includes branding and communication, so setting up our website that we've put kind of the bare bones on the website now so people can subscribe to stay tuned. This will be include some mapping exercises and really looking at the fiscal side of the general plan and the land use decisions we'll be making. And really this will gather a series of input. Our first round will be called the vision for the future. And we have 3 rounds of community engagement that are really robust. Each phase, phases 2, 3, and 4, include meetings with stakeholders and public workshops, 2 meetings with our council members and our planning commissioners, and really a big conversation, including some online engagement. So we're reaching out in all different ways. We've realized our engagement has really increased since we've allowed people to participate virtually, people who have children or don't leave the home as often. This really allows people to participate. So I was really impressed with the scope of work that our consultant team put together for a robust and diverse outreach process. Phase 3, about $150,000, and that focuses on developing the preliminary general plan alternatives and analyzing those. So that'll include a fiscal impact analysis of those alternatives, looking at the impact on public services, looking at how that affects our general fund, and net fiscal impact on general fund. So, and of course, safety. That's a really big piece of the safety, resilience, and sustainability. So that's a really big piece that I know we've talked about over the last couple months is how do we envision our future and make sure that everything we're doing, you know, we are fiscally sound, we are able to provide services, knowing that we have a lot of housing and not as much commercial and jobs as some other communities. So making sure that we, no matter how we grow and what our population build out is in our general plan scenario 2045, we are able to support those services in a high quality. And then, of course, I mentioned our second round of engagement, which would be exploring the possibilities and refinement and finalization of a preferred alternative so we can dig into the EIR process, which follows. There are some optional tasks, which I'll walk through now, and we can talk about those at the end of the presentation if these kind of are palatable to council and you'd like to consider rolling these into the scope of work. We have the opportunity and flexibility to do that. So number one, actually it's optional task six, it's a youth design charrette. There was a lot of conversation in our scoping meeting about bringing the future of our youth and our community to the table and engaging them in a meaningful way. So MIG has designed a task that includes a charrette that we can use to bring to the high schools, collaborate with the teachers, and have student groups kind of study a series of urban design challenges and kind of work through those concepts and solutions and present their ideas, which would be really interesting because you really can't have a conversation about the future without the future in the room. So that's one option. We talked a little bit about this tongue-in-cheek earlier, but a plan van to kind of help us share, and maybe you just make this outreach process, like we kind of joked, go viral and help get the word out in a way where there's a QR code or a website on the side of a van that is one of our existing city fleet, and you can kind of wrap it. You've seen those kind of print jobs, and really do something to get people to engage and know how to find information about this project. And so maybe it contains information. People can hand that out when they have their plan van driving around. But wrapping our one or so of our existing fleet can do that. Task number eight, social media program. The consultant team can manage a Facebook and Twitter feed and keep that current and engage that segment of the population that is really active on Twitter and Facebook, make sure that we're getting everybody, not just the usual suspects that know how to engage through our typical processes at forums like this at a city council meeting. So that would be another option to diversify our outreach strategy. And finally, if we wanted to consider a scientifically valid community survey or statistically valid survey, we can also opt to do that. Maybe we can do that at a later date. We'll have some flexibility if we want to do an ad services, but it's something I wanted you all to see and consider. So phase four, plan for Atascadero. So this phase is about $400,000, and it includes kind of constructing and organizing our general plan in the way that we see it most useful for our community. This includes a CEQA analysis, which is our initial checklist, and then coming up with a public draft plan for everyone to review in the community and provide input on. We would do a third series of public engagement, prepare a general plan environmental impact report, or EIR, and that would be a program-level draft EIR. That's something to talk about as optional tasks as well. And that would really help us kind of streamline our entitlements and CEQA work in the future for this. We do have some optional tasks for phase four. I mentioned program-level EIR. So optional task two would be project-level EIR. So we've kind of put a set aside for $100,000 based on what this could look like. This is kind of a contingent number. It's really going to be determined when the preferred general plan alternative is determined and when we actually have sites that we would like to actually analyze. But this project-level EIR can evaluate what potential zone changes for larger projects could look like and what kind of mitigation measures we might want to think about as part of that. And I can kind of let Phil talk to that a little bit too, but there's a difference between program and project level, and this gets to a higher level of analysis that looks at more of the circulation of a larger project, say like Barrel Creek, for example, or if it was a very large project like Eagle Ranch, which, you know, was looked at years ago.
And I think when we get to questions and answers, we can probably get into that in a little more detail. As council weighs which is the best for our community, what helps us the best. But on just a very basic level, the EIR that's already in the contract, not the optional one, is the more typical thing you do with a general plan and circulation element analysis. Excuse me. And it helps you streamline projects. It looks at land use changes. It looks at circulation changes. It looks at all of the changes that could occur in your community over a prolonged period of time, 20 years. Whereas the project level would really get in down to a private development project. And I'm not sure that the city of Atascadero currently has private development projects that meet that scope or scale. Typically, that project level analysis would be done if you had a very large annexation proposed, or if you had a very large project that you knew was going to trigger on its own an environmental impact report, and by including that project into it would help streamline that project and further the goals of the city.
Thank you, Phil. So we talked a little bit about the benefits to the city, and really there's also benefits to property owners if you dug into that, and we found that it was necessary as far as streamlining review, which we talk a lot about. Our project level, program level EIR will do some of that as well. It really looks at the city as a whole and how build out will look with updated zoning and land use changes, and that would give us an opportunity to kind of look at it holistically as far as what is our general plan number build out in total, and what do we need to do to mitigate that. One other optional task is an emergency operations plan. We've asked MIG to give us a scope of work, and one of their subconsultants quoted us for about $72,000 to develop an emergency operation plan that includes regulatory requirements and guidance. It's kind of an implementation measure of this, whereas of the general plan safety element. We will have a safety element that will be included in our general plan, but this is an actual implementation strategy that actually looks at supporting the execution of an emergency operation plan during incidents. Phase 5 and 6, kind of wrapping this up. Phase 5 is about $100,000, and this includes administrative draft EIR, final draft EIR, 2 Planning Commission public hearings, 2 City Council public hearings, and our final general plan, which will come in the form of an online e-plan format for navigation. And this really is a long process of getting through our reviews and making sure the community has ample time to respond to this and ask questions as we refine our draft and final general plan and EIR. And finally, phase 6 just accounts for the management of the subconsultant and team that MIG will be doing, and ongoing meetings for 2 years of this project and project administration. So here's kind of an overview of the optional tasks that I rolled into this overall presentation. We can come back to that in a moment, but ultimately our recommendation here, we'll go through fiscal impact first before we get to recommendation, but the fiscal impact will for phases 2 through 6 for the MIG contract will result in a base expenditure of $1,072,257 of general funds, and that is because $43,000 of that has already been allocated for phase 1. So these optional tasks are not included in this. We can consider those now and talk through any of those that might be interesting to council. And budgeted funds, per your staff report, we actually have allocated $1,085,000 over the next 2 fiscal years. So there would be we're looking at an additional appropriation from the general fund reserves for $141,000 for contingency. So looking at the very bottom here, we have our what's allocated, what we're asking for, and the total funding sources. So now with recommendation, we're looking for council to authorize the city manager to amend the contract with MIG, adding the scope phases 2 through 6 of the preparation of the general plan update at a cost of $1,072,257 to bring the total contract cost to $1,115,273. You can also, we're looking to authorize the Director of Administrative Services to appropriate an additional $141,800 in general fund reserves for the general plan update for contingency, which is typical for projects of this size and this duration. With that, I'd love to turn it over to any questions or talk through optional tasks, anything you'd like.
Thank you, Lorelei. Could you, before we look at the optional tasks, could you go, I think it's one screen further. There we go.
Yeah.
So number one, this is really exciting. We've been in what I would call the pre-planning phase for quite a while to bring us to this point. And by quite a while, I mean years. We've been talking about this. So we're all really excited to start in on this process. Phase one, we began back on January 28th and a little before that with Council and Planning Commission coming together and a lot of you that participated. And so, Lorelei, if we're all understanding correctly, phases 2 through 6 that we're being asked to approve and authorize the amendment of the agreement tonight came out of that meeting that we had, that community-wide meeting with Planning and Commission and Council. And so we're looking at these items, and then the optional tasks also came out of that, but they weren't a solid go-ahead. It was sort of, this is some possibilities we want to look at. So what I would like to do is I would like to take this in two pieces. First, if there are any council questions related to specifically phases 2 through 6 and to the contract itself that we're authorizing the change to, then let's look at the optional items. So let's kind of separate the two, see if we've got questions on the first, then we'll go to the optional items. Okay? All right. So I will look to council members. Council Member Funk, followed by Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, and thank you, Lorelei. This is indeed an exciting venture that we are launching forth. I am wondering, with regard to these things, by adding the specific fiscal piece into the core package, will we be able to get an analysis of how our land use designs affect the stability of the tax base of the city? Because one of the things we struggle with here, as you know, is that we have a relatively small retail base, as was pointed out earlier today, and therefore the smaller tax revenue than any of the other cities in the county per capita, and that limits our ability to serve all of the housing and other things that we want to have in our community. So I want to see how that plays out over time. Will that be in the package?
Yes, and the good news is that we heard loud and clear on the 28th of January when we had our study session that the fiscal impacts were very important to this project. So in this base scope, it is fully included to have an analysis of what it costs our community to serve each of our residents and our houses, our housing types, as well as just general services. So there is a high level of analysis because that was very important. There's also an economic development element scoped in this too. That can look however we'd like it to in the final deliverable, but we will be analyzing economic analysis, which is economic development, which is one side of it, our city's overall health and well-being, and we are also looking at the fiscal impacts of what it costs to serve each home and what we need to be fiscally, you know, sound as a community as well. So very high-level analysis in both our phase two when we're doing our initial kind of studies, and then again when we have our general plan alternatives, looking at all three of those and then doing a very deep analysis and deep dive into the final preferred alternative, which would actually show us in the end an implementation element, which is scoped as part of this project too, to say, well, how are we going to do all of these things?
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
My question, Lorelei, would be more along the lines of a timeline and guidance of how each phase or when we anticipate each phase is going to start or how long that duration of phase is going to last.
That is great question. This is going to be a two-year project. We will be wrapping, we kind of foresee at the end of 2023. We do have our consultant and Laura Stetson on the line. And Laura, I'm not sure if you're mic is active, but I'd love to pull you up and have you talk through that and address that question about the length and duration of each of our phases.
Yes, thank you, Lorelei. Thank you, Madam Mayor and members of the council. It's nice to be before you again. I apologize, Councilperson Newsom, that I don't have handy in front of me the schedule. And Lorelei, I don't know if it was part of the package that you might be able to pull that up and share. But this is an iterative process. And I think the important thing is that as we move through the schedule, we've got a community engagement phase that provides a check back at each time. So we'll go to a certain decision point, check with the council, check with the community, check back in with the council. And so that's the way the overall schedule works, is feedback loops, if you will. But we will not move, that ensures that we don't move on to the next phase until we get buy-off on the first phase. And I can see Lorelei still maybe looking for the schedule and how this rolls out. But did you have a particular question or concern about a specific phase or a specific task and the time that it would occur so it doesn't interfere with school calendar or anything of note in the community that's important to make sure that we dovetail things with?
As we're looking at the optional tasks, when do you anticipate phase three will start?
I'm looking for that information too, Laura, see if I can pull up the graphic. But in the meantime, if you have that handy.
I know the schedule timeline was last packet, sorry.
And if we need to come back to that one, but if you've got another question that you want to move forward with, then we can come back to that answer when we find it.
Thank you. I'm not seeing it in the packet that was provided.
No worries.
And
we'll wait. We'll move on to the next.
Okay.
Yes. Councilmember Borbo.
Yeah, I have several questions relating to my concern about the overall cost of this. You know, there's $1 million of general fund money, which is quite a large amount. And this is a question for Mr. Dunsmore, because Phil, you were with the City of San Luis Obispo Community Development Department when they did their LUCE, or the land use and circulation element. If I recall correctly, SLO got like $1 million grant to, right around the neighborhood of this dollar amount to do that. And I'm not sure who that grant was from, but is that correct?
Is correct, and that grant was funded from the Strategic Growth Council, and it was aimed at specifically sustainable growth. And when San Luis Obispo did their update, it was strictly their land use and circulation elements, and even those two elements alone were over that $1 million amount, and this is about a decade ago. So right. It's interesting you compare the two costs. But, yeah, we were successful in getting that grant, and we are desperately looking for grants similarly. We're actually looking at the Strategic Growth Council website pretty much every week to see if there's updates, right. And looking at other resources as well. It is very difficult within a community like ours where we don't have a disadvantaged category. We don't have a lot of other sectors that really provide us a lot of opportunities, but we're still looking. We're hopeful.
So this is another situation where City of SLO, despite having three times the per capita revenue of us, is a disadvantaged community and is eligible for more grants?
Yes.
Okay. So, we're not likely to get that particular kind of grant, I guess. Concern is, is mentioned in the last part of the staff report that, you'll continue to try to get grants. Once we embark on this process, appropriating our own general fund money, though, does that kind of knock us out of the running of getting grants?
It does not.
Okay.
A lot of these grants you can use retroactively, and you can dial back. So that's still a potential.
Great.
So the chance is we might get a partial funding grant, but maybe not in its entirety. So.
Sure. Anything would help. It's always ironic to watch SLO get money for being, quote, disadvantaged. And then along the lines of the cost question, though, in phase two, and this might be a question for the consultant, there are several technical studies listed, biological resources, technical study, cultural resources, technical study, et cetera, et cetera. Are those things where the consultant then will be engaging a sub-consultant with expertise in those areas? And are all of those required pieces of this puzzle?
Let's have our Laura answer that question specifically, but I believe that it is sub-consultant work. Are you looking at the EIR section when you're looking at those?
No, I'm looking on page 52 under phase two, discovering and visioning. It just says the phase will include numerous technical studies and mapping.
Councilmember Barbeau, yes, indeed. We will have sub-consultants working on that, and in particular, we have people engaged who have worked frequently on the Central Coast and know the geography and the people and the environments very well. That initial investigation, if you will, provides two things. Number one, it helps us craft the land use plan to know where the constraints and opportunities are, but that those technical studies also help set the setting for the subsequent environmental analysis. So it helps shape and it helps inform. And we have engaged with SWCA, a local based firm to do the biological resource, cultural resource. We also have an engineering firm on board to help with those assessments, including working with your public works staff on infrastructure issues. And we have a local traffic engineer who will be doing the traffic investigations.
Okay, but it sounds like, in answer to my question, those are either required or essentially they're needed to properly complete the EIR portion?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. And then under phase four, you've mentioned this before, of course, the required elements of the general plan. And then there's two that are listed with an asterisk that are optional, and that is economic development, which we're up here all very concerned with, and the public services infrastructure element, fiscal sustainability element, which we're also, of course, very concerned of. So we do want that looked at. But are those, since they're optional elements, if they're addressed within one of the other elements, is there an efficient way to do that? Is it more efficient, less costly to incorporate them in the other required elements, or is it really make no difference whether they be their separate element or just something we want addressed within the mandatory elements?
It makes no difference cost-wise. We would address it at the same level of detail. It just depends on the presentation of that material, whether you'd like it to be standalone or very frequently economic development is built into land use because of the relationships there. But sometimes cities like to have a separate economic development element as a marketing tool, if you will, to show the importance of economic development and attracting new businesses and what types of new businesses to the community. So it lays a foundation for, future strategic plans.
Got it.
It's just a matter of choice.
Okay, thank you.
I can go ahead and pull up the response to Councilmember Newsom's question as well. We have the general plan process graphic, which is also on our project website. If you Google 2045 Atascadero General Plan Update, you can find this. So she asked a little bit about the phase three, exploring alternatives, and that begins in months 9 through 12. So about a year from now, we'll be entering into that because we're a couple months in right now to the process. So this time next year, we will be exploring alternatives and in our community engagement series number 2. You can also see that, let me just minimize this slightly. I hope that's not too much of an eye chart. months 1 through 2 were phase 1. Phase 2 includes months 3 through 8. Phase 3 includes months 9 through 12. Phase 4, where we're really tightening up the general plan document, is months 13 through 20. You can see how much time and energy goes into that process. And then phase 5, which is really the kind of adoption process, is months 21 through 24. And that'll get us to the end of, not this year, but next. That's a 2-year process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lorelei. And again, can you let people know the URL for following the updates on the general plan?
Absolutely. Let me pull that up. Actually, I'll get back to you on that one while
okay,
we're doing. I'll pull
you.
It up on the screen.
And I have a question for Mr. Densmore. As we're looking at, one of the things we'll look at in the next section of our conversation is the optional elements. So when it comes to the program, not project, but program EIR, can you help the council to understand what benefits from that accrue to any particular project? So, for example, we've got a list of applicants, you know, over the last few years that have kind of raised their hand and said, hey, I'd like to have a general plan amendment. And we've said, okay, we're pulling together a list of, you know, of applicants because we don't have the time and resources to devote to that right now. We're going to wrap this into the general plan. So it could be somebody with, you know, a 4-acre lot who wants to do a lot split in a residential area. Or it could be somebody with, you know, a commercial lot that wants to change to residential or vice versa. You have something, you mentioned Barrel Creek, so we've got something much larger, 18 acres, that would like to convert to a higher density, you know, mixed use. So in looking at all of those types of things that we know we have on the, you know, on the horizon and interested developers and investors and even just individual property owners, what types of benefits from the program EIR accrue to any of those particular projects?
It all depends on the final plan that we decide to make. But in any case, if we do decide as a community that we would like to rezone certain portions of our city, whether or not they're in response to those particular individual requests, it definitely helps out those property owners and those particular projects, because the rezoning or the general plan amendment for those projects is perhaps the most significant action and the most significant when it comes to an environmental review. Because changing the zoning, for example, let's say I've got a large 10-acre property and it's zoned single family and my minimum lot size is 2.5 acres and I want to go to commercial and I want to go to multifamily, well, the intensity of that development is raised incrementally and so are the environmental impacts. So without looking at even a specific project, the EIR for the general plan will look at a worst case scenario given that new land use scenario and put that into the EIR and evaluate it and complete that evaluation, complete that environmental review. So therefore, when that property owner does want to do a project, they've already got that done. They won't have to do their own EIR, and they'll have a streamlined process to go through. So it's very helpful. The other part of your question I want to get to is, yes, we have been opening the door to people submitting requests to the city to rezone their property. Those aren't real, general plan amendment rezoning requests. What they are is really an invitation to be part of the process. That's essentially the first part of our outreach process to our community, to let folks know that, hey, we're doing an update. Let us know what the interest is on your particular property. And we're still accepting those now. It's sort of an invitation to be part of the process, and everyone's invited to be part of the process should they see something on a property that they have or have an interest in that they think should be rezoned. They could submit that application of interest that we'll hold and include as we get through our analysis of our general plan. Doesn't mean there's a guarantee that their property will actually get rezoned, but it's taken into consideration for the larger process, which is really helpful for us.
Yeah, there's really a benefit all around in this, because it benefits us to, you know, really get our zoning updated into the 21st century. Would that be correct? I'm looking at Ryan Betts over there. we all know our zoning code is quite outdated. And so, you know, part of this process will be that. So there will certainly be a benefit to the city, but also a benefit in terms of attracting, you know, developers, investors who want to do something here, and then a benefit to the folks who own the properties that, you know, I know some of you have had to wait a while for us to get to this point, and you wanted things done earlier, and if we had capacity, we would have been happy to take a look at that. But in your waiting, gratefully, that this is some benefit that you'll be able to get from that. So thank you for clarifying that. I think that's very helpful to know. All right. I think we've exhausted questions then on kind of the piece we already knew a lot about. So why don't we pull up the slide on the different options? And I'm going to assume that Councilmember Borbeau is going to say no, 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 no on the options.
Do we need to go out to the public?
I'm putting on
yet,
the fiscal or? Hat. No, I'm just doing these two pieces, then we'll go out to the public.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
sorry.
We're
great.
Still on questions.
All right, I'll move to that slide. In the meantime, for those of you who do not have video and just have audio.
Good point, Phil. I didn't mean to make it sound like we were deciding right now.
The general plan website, update website, is www.atascadero.org/general-plan-2045.
Thank you, Lorelei.
Yeah, and then we can go back.
So let's go ahead and go to that screen. And of those six options, What questions does council have on any of these items? I'll look to, we used to have lights, but now I'm just kind of looking to people. Council Member Borbo?
Yeah, on question for staff on the social media program, I'm assuming, you know, if the consultant did not do that, we would essentially have to do something like that with staff to have some sort of a social media presence on this. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes. If our consultant team, who has a pretty deep bench of folks who kind of specialize in this, if they didn't take this on, we would need to figure out a way to allocate staff time to make this happen, and we could probably see what we could do to work with Terry Banish's team and our own community development team, but we would have to kind of come up with our own strategy and see what we could do to support this effort.
Okay. Yes, thank you for the answer.
You know how much spare time Terry has. Council Member
That's
Darris.
Why I ask.
If you could discuss a little bit on the scientifically valid community survey and how that works and yeah, just basically how it works and what it's going to entail.
Yeah, I'd love to throw that to Laura Stetson. I know with community engagement, you can do online surveys all day long, but unless they're statistically valid, it's really hard to make sure you're getting a true sample of the population. So, Laura, do you want to go ahead and talk about what constitutes a scientifically valid community survey?
Sure, Councilmember. It would depend. Well, this could be done at a couple of pinch points or touch points in the program. It could be done to understand what the community's vision is and to craft a series of questions that would get to that answer. It could be done when there are land use alternatives that we would like the community to weigh in on. Those would be the two key points to do it. It would be done as a phone survey, looking at a scientifically balanced sample size of the community. It used to be more difficult with cell phones because with people's area codes, you know, you're never quite sure anymore if they're in on the Central Coast or in Michigan or wherever. But the folks who did those types of surveys have figured out how to drill down and get into the community and to get a balance of those representative sample of the community. That'd probably be about a 200 to 300 sample size for that cost. It would go up if the sample size were larger.
Thank you. And this would be done strictly just by phone then? There's no other process or way of doing this?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
To follow up on Councilmember DeRiz's question on this, in what phase or when would that scientifically valid community survey be done? Would it be done towards the beginning, talk about what do people want, or would it be done later to say here's some options and some alternatives that have been developed, what do you think? When would that actually be done in the process?
It could be done at either point, depending on what the council feels they'd like to hear most about. Would it be part of the vision for the community, or would it be when you are asking the community to weigh in on the various options? So either way, it strategically depends on what the council would like to hear through this scientific survey.
And I don't know how many, you know, these general plan updates you've done. My question would be, in the universe of how many you've done, what proportion of cities have done that particular piece?
The scientific survey, I've been doing general plans for about 35 years. I think of the 40 to 50 general plans I've done, maybe 4 have done scientifically valid surveys.
Okay, and those 4, which represents, let's say, 10% of the ones you've done, do they, you know, did you find them to be particularly useful and provide a superior outcome to, you know, the 90% that didn't do it? Or can you comment on that?
It's just one method of outreach among many. We like to find different ways to reach into the community. I would venture to say that it did not substantially change decision-making or outcomes associated with the projects.
Okay. Thank you very much.
One other piece of information.
Got it. Thank you.
Councilmember Funk.
Yes, thank you, Madam Mayor. A couple questions here. With regard to the survey, it strikes me that that's likely to be useful only if there's a really close call on a very specific set of decisions where that would be important. Can we make that decision later as to whether we find ourselves, where it would really be valuable?
Yes, you could hold off on making that decision. And I think the point where you would want to know would be at the alternative stage. If you're looking for something that's more targeted and scientifically valid, that would be the point to do that. And that could be a year from now.
Okay. With regard
Mayor,
to...
just really quick, I just want to kind of set the stage. We have the ability to issue change orders throughout the length of the contract. What we're really looking for tonight are there some that, hey, we absolutely know that we need this exactly right now when we want to build it into our base. If I'm expecting, that's why we build in contingencies in the budget, that there will be things that come up along the way that you go, you know what, I really think that we need a scientifically valid survey, or we really need the social media program to kick in because it's that. Or maybe we don't use the entire social media program, we plan on doing it in-house and using them for just a portion. So you always have that flexibility. But we did want to put the whole gamut in front of you in case there were some that were very strong, like, no, we want this built in right away. So just wanted to set that table.
Great. Thank you. With regard to the social media program that you mentioned it, can I assume that it would include Instagram as well as Facebook? Because it's that younger group that's more on Insta than Facebook that we really need to engage in that.
Yes, no matter what, we would have Instagram, Facebook. We have a number of things that the city has a presence on, in addition to the tools that the consultant can bring to it. So, yes.
Okay.
Councilwoman Clark, I think we're already working on a general plan TikTok dance.
yeah. I think that goes with the plan wrap.
Something that will never come across our screens, I'm sure.
yeah. Yeah. Youth Design Charrette, have we been in conversation with teachers at the high school and students at the high school to find out if they are really keen on having this or any of that yet?
We have not done that outreach yet.
Okay. That might be something our city schools committee could explore or, you know, whatever venue, but it seems like that we'd want to at least find out.
We do have some strong connections with the leadership classes and teachers who are really excited to be involved in government and other things. So if there's if this is something we want to move forward with, we're having conversations with how to engage them in our community otherwise, too. We'll just bring this up and make it happen.
Sure. And at that point that we do that, can we give them a couple of alternatives so that we have sort of because this sounds like the charrette is a much more involved process and involves more classroom time and gives kids a much bigger stay in that. But we want to make sure that they're ready for that as opposed to having a focus group that would be a little bit or a series of focus groups that they're a constituency that we want to be in touch with. Regardless, the question is at which level.
Yeah, MIG is very creative. Their team is bilingual and savvy and very engaged with the youth. I think we would sit down and say, how do we need to make sure that they're prepared for this excellent charrette? So it's very successful, and we would make a plan that was bulletproof.
Okay, and we are talking high school, not, say, elementary.
We could. There's lots of opportunities. I think high school would give a lot of input because they have student government that's pretty fine-tuned. But, I've done things where I've had assemblies with younger students in elementary schools. So I know that this is specifically designed for high school level per their scope of work. But that doesn't mean staff can't take and do a couple other of, take a little workshop box with us based on what MIG does here for this youth charrette at the high school and take it around and make sure that we're working with the middle school leadership class or student government mm-hmm. or even the elementary schools. There's opportunities as long as we have staff capacity.
Okay, and speaking of staff capacity, would we be able to split the social media thing so that you got the design piece from the consultants and then more of the ongoing execution of that plan be something that our staff could fine-tune and run.
I think absolutely. As you said, Meg is very flexible and a great consultant, and we could split that to make it manageable for both parts and figure out what we truly do just need.
Okay. That's it for me.
Thank you. Any? Seeing no others. I have a question regarding the project level EIR analysis. So my understanding, so this would go to Director Dunsmore, is that this would be more specific to, you know, as it says, a project. And so that would be something where the city would need to feel fairly certain that something's going through, because then in doing this, that is accruing a benefit that is project specific. And you could make an argument that that is a benefit to the entire city if it is indeed a project that benefits the entire city in some way, shape, or form, if we make that, you know, nexus, if you will. Yet we can't always be assured that a project goes through. Over decades, things happen with the economy and projects come and go. So as it relates to the project level EIR analysis, that to me seems like it's a bit more like isolated and risky and doesn't maybe produce the benefit that it sounds like it might.
There's not a lot of risk to it, except for the fact that you're wasting funds.
Well, that's what I mean.
That's the risk.
Charles and I consider that
yes,
a big risk.
That is a risk, certainly, because you can't force a project to happen.
Right.
We can put in place zoning, which is what we evaluate with an EIR typically. And if you wanted to, if there was one or more projects that you felt were significant to the entire community that helped forward our entire community, we could latch onto those and do that. It doesn't feel like we have projects of that magnitude at this mm-hmm. particular point in our community that reach that level. And certainly, yes, there is a risk, because even if you did that environmental analysis on that project-specific level, there's no guarantee that project will happen. The zoning might stay in place, and a whole different project may happen. So,
yeah. Okay. Thank you for helping to clarify that. Councilmember Bourbeau, you have a follow-up?
I do to that question. When I was a little confused by this as well, because, I mean, I don't believe we should be doing a project-level EIR on behalf of a single individual project. I could see it if you had something like the entire Del Rio area, where we have a collective community-wide, city council level interest in the economic development of the entire node around the Del Rio interchange, all four sides. But I'm taking that you couldn't really do an EIR for that node because you don't know what the specific projects to be proposed are, even though some of them are coming into view a little bit. So I guess I was just confused how, this could be done in a way that would be beneficial to a whole area or to a whole class of projects, let's say, like tiny houses or something like that, or, three-story apartment buildings downtown or something. So I was just trying to understand how this could actually be of benefit to the community as a whole and not just to a specific property owner.
It feels like it would have more of a benefit to specific property owners than it would community-wide, unless we had projects that were of community-wide magnitude, or let's say they're public projects. Let's say we had a wastewater treatment plant upgrade that triggered significant environmental impacts. We might want to include that. Or if we had significant other infrastructure improvements that triggered significant environmental impacts, we might want to include those because those would have community benefit and wouldn't be private property development. Or if there's an entire annexation area that has all kinds of different things going on with a multitude of land uses and projects, that might be something that falls in that level as well. So those are the kind of reasons I see that you'd go to that level of environmental review, but I'm not sure that we have those things on the table at this particular juncture.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think, have we exhausted our questions? I believe so. So we're going to go ahead and open up to public comment. So if there's anyone here in the chambers that wishes to speak to this item, please come to the podium. If there's anyone in the webinar, go ahead and raise your hand using the icon at the bottom, or if you're on the phone, go ahead and press *9. Welcome.
Good evening, Council. Once again, Jeff Oslin. Could you bring back the Phase 3 option slide, please. I have a few questions I'd actually like to ask. First of all, before we get to that, the entire budget, if you break it down over a 20-year general plan, that's $50,000 a year, doesn't sound as bad as $1 million going out. Secondly, though, the concern is that we're hitting reserves, and I'm always fearful when we hit our city's reserve. We are a very fiscally responsible city, and that part scares the heck out of me, to be honest. So I think we need to look at that reserve and see what we can do. Going back to the summary of Phase 3, if we could put back the Phase 3 optional task that was just up there, that would be helpful. That's fine right there. I think the youth design is brilliant and needs to be in this plan. And I would take it one step further, and you might find a couple folks at the junior high that actually know what's going on. As one that does foster care, we've learned a lot. And the youth is a lot smarter on technology than us. I hate to say it. QR codes make a lot of sense. They have them on menus before you and I can flip out a phone and have it. They know how to get them fast. So I think that's something that we should definitely look at. In 0.7, I don't understand the wrap. It said on the top of a city vehicle. How do you get a QR code off the top of a city vehicle? I'm confused. Like, clarification on that. QR codes can be pretty much sent anywhere now, on buildings, on paper, on the television screen. Maybe we should look into that a little bit better. That might be a great option for us. And then when it comes to social media, I thought we just hired a social media person for our city. And if that's the case, I'm confused why we would need to spend that much money to outsource that. So those are my concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will go ahead and look to the webinar and see My screen keeps moving around. All right, there we go. Now I see the attendees. Anybody in the webinar wishing to speak, go ahead and press that raise hand icon at the bottom of the screen. If you're on the phone, go ahead and press *9. I'm looking to Luke. We don't have anybody on the phone, and I'm not seeing anyone in the webinar. It's kind of exciting stuff, folks. At least we think it is. Come on, anybody. All right, I'm not seeing anybody wishing to speak, so we'll go ahead and close public comment and bring it back. A van wrap would be, if you think of a vehicle wrap that where like a business has it and you wrap it with advertisement or something like that, and so you could have a QR code on it, and you could have all sorts of things on this van that tools around the city and is advertising the... Oh, on the top, I think we... mean around the van, I would assume. All right. So let's do this. Let's go ahead and pull up those options and go through those, and let's just do a quick straw on those, and I want to see where everybody sits, yay or nay, or where we are. So I'm just going to kind of go from my left to my right. So Mark, Councilmember Darris.
Am I just the first one here then?
Go through. There we go. Zero, 2, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Project level EIR? No, I don't think it's necessary, especially based on the discussion. I think Phil explained it well. I think there might be times when we would need it, but I don't think that's going to come up now. So I think that is not a wise expenditure of $100,000.
Keep going.
Oh, all the way down. I thought we were going to go one at a time.
Right.
I think getting the youth design charrette, that would be really interesting to see some of our kids involved in the high school level would be nice. The van wrap thing, I think of community outreach. I am somewhat supportive of that. I think most people might not even understand what we're doing here or even aware that we are, and this would get the word out, and they would get into looking into our website and whatever. I didn't think about the QR code. That's a certain good thing to have. So I'm somewhat in favor of that. Social media... again, we've already got a social media team. I don't know if we need both.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that was something Mr. Oslin asked. So maybe if their city manager could speak to that concern brought up.
We did add a position in this budget. We are in the process of filling it. It should be filled March 30th.
And that person will be in charge of social media and website update, cleaning up our website, helping all the departments keep their website information current and all of that. So they will be part of Terry's team. Amanda Muther is going to be filling that position, and we'll be dedicated to that. So, yes, we do have somebody on
staff. You speak to the need of, say, somebody to do the social media program through MIG versus Amanda taking that on amongst her other duties?
So, obviously, we do a lot of social media. We do a lot of Facebook, Instagram, QR codes, a lot of those things. Certainly, being able to tap MIG for their expertise on different programs or different things that they've seen, some recommendations type of thing. So it might be something of a hybrid approach. I probably would recommend that, and we could talk to MIG and figure that out. That's not necessarily something that we need to decide tonight, but certainly hearing from you that social media presence and a strong social media program is important would be helpful.
Thank you.
Right. So I think the social media is an important aspect, but how we do it, if it's necessary to be as part of this expense, maybe something we can explore. The emergency operations plan, it sounds to me like I think this is something we were going to do anyway down the road or in the next couple of years. And I know that number is not correct. It's about double right. That, 72,000. Mm-hmm. I would say that it's probably, we can do that on our own outside of this general plan. And in the scientific, the survey, it doesn't sound like it's of a great value. Maybe that's 25,000 that could be spent someplace else if necessary, but I would opt not to do the survey for such a small sample of what we might be getting information from.
Thank you. Councilmember Borbo.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm glad Councilmember DeRiz brought up the fact that this number for the emergency plan is off and the cost would actually be doubled, so we can accommodate that another way. The only one of these that I'm supportive of is the social media program if the city manager determines that it can't be done internally. So, in other words, I'd be open to including that as an option within the contract itself, but only to be executed after you determine that our in-house folks cannot perform that.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
I really like the youth design. I think I'm one of the ones that recommended that idea. I think that we need youth involvement of all ages. I think it's vital to making a plan for 2045 that affects them. I think it would be a great, great program to get the kids involved, to be a part of something that's going to be lasting in their community for years and years to come. Second thing I'd be interested in is social media. However, I'd like to see it done more at the city level, if possible, with our city staff resources to save a little bit of money so that we can have the youth design program. Thanks.
And Councilmember Funk.
Yeah. No, on the project level EIR, same reasons as others. The only thing that we would have that would merit that, I think, if we were going to try to do something with Eagle Ranch, and the hurdles to make that work are just so enormous because it's so far out of our infrastructure that it doesn't make any sense to me to do that. I am very interested in the youth design charrette. I want to make sure that we're not imposing something that our teachers and students aren't eager for, but on the assumption that they are, in fact, that if we budget it and we find out that they really are not ready for that level of involvement, that we can redirect that. I work with that. I get the cool factor on a plan wrap, but I also think that we have some of our constituents who would look at that and feel like it is a colossal waste of money. And I think on balance that the value of that is not, the potential blowback is not worth the cost of it. Social media, I'd like to see us tap into MIG as needed for supportive and design work and supportive work and execute that through staff. Update emergency operations we can skip and do that ourselves. And community-wide survey, we should only consider that if later down in the process we find that there's a particular issue that we, you know, or a set of issues that we really need very clear feedback, and that it can be structured in a way to make that useful.
Thank you. All right, so what we're looking at is we're all going to say no on the project level EIR. I would agree that the youth design charrette, I think, is important. There are a lot of things that we're doing here that it's easy to think, well, couldn't staff just get with the school's committee and get with the teachers and pull all this together? And as you know from everything we talked about through going out for D20 and our need for increased capacity at the city level, these kinds of things, we can't ask our staff to do more. They're already doing a lot, even as it pertains to the EIR. So we don't make any of these decisions lightly. We make it based upon what do we think is really important in terms of the EIR and what is our staff's current capacity. So I would agree with the charrette. So I think we have a majority agreement there. And I agree, as Councilmember Funk said, I think and it's even beyond the cool factor. I think people will see it, and it can kind of stick in their mind. Something you have to see several times. You see it there, and then you see it in social media, and you see it somewhere else. But then there is the potential of, wow, what a big waste of money. I could kind of go one way or the other, but the sense I'm getting is that we're not on board with that, so I'm fine saying no to that. Social media, I think, is important that we tap into MIG and what they can do. And as the city goes through and we see what Amanda can be doing with the expertise of MIG, I know that we do not have a staff that just says, great, I've got a check to go do this. They're always looking at ways to maximize efficiency and economize things. So I think we need to move forward with that. Yes, again, the emergency plan, we'll do that on our own. The cost is way too high there. And the statistically valid survey, I think, is something that if we do see a need later on, we could come back and take a look at that. But I think tonight we would all say no. So what I would look to my colleagues for is a motion to authorize the amendment of the contract and including options 6 and 8 as indicated.
I'll make that motion.
I will second it. And Madam Mayor, if I may comment before we call the roll, just to note, this is a really big investment. This has been in our city's financial strategies and in our budgets. If looking forward, for the entire time that I've served on this council, we knew this was coming. We planned for it. We can't not do it because we're required to have a general plan. Mm-hmm. And it is really critical for... I mean, it is the general plan that we go back to every time somebody comes up and has a new idea of what it is that they want to do with their property, and we have to figure out whether that meets the criteria that the community has agreed on about that, so that everybody's playing by the same set of rules. So having that updated is important and valuable, and I'm honored to second the motion.
All right. Mayor, before you call roll, can I just get a clarification so
yes.
I understand? You would like me to, let's say, council authorize the city manager to amend the contract with MIG, adding Correct. The scope of phases 2 through 6, including the youth charrette and the full social media? I'm getting texts from Terry.
I'm going to say it's up to the full social media, but you use your judgment in terms of where we see we can minimize that if available, but we want to give you that maximum amount if needed.
Okay. For the preparation of the general plan at a total cost of, if it was the full amount, $1,097,507, and that you authorize the Director of Administrative Services to appropriate an additional... That
10%.
Would make it $167,050.
Perfect.
Would that work?
Yes.
Is that what the motion is?
Yes,
okay.
It is. Glad
Thank
you brought your calculator.
I'll confirm those calculations.
Yeah, when we're at home and we've got the 10 key next to us, we can do that, but it's harder to do on the phone. It doesn't work. All right, we have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Newsom and a second by Councilmember Funk. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Borbo?
Yes.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Anybody need a break? How are we doing? Okay, we're going to take a 5-minute break and be back. Let's see, it's 7:32. Why don't we take an 8-minute break to 7:40, and we'll see you back. All right, we are moving on to our second management report, and this is regarding a third meeting in a row now. We've been talking about Senate Bill 1383, and this is the Recovered Organic Waste Products Procurement Requirements, and this will be our Deputy City Manager, Ms. Laura Christensen.
Oh, thank you, Mayor. Let me go ahead and share my screen. Okay, SB 1383, because we're not tired of it yet. Really quick, so anyone who's just joining us, maybe hasn't participated the last couple meetings, SB 1383 was regulations that were signed into law back in 2016. They are regulations and requirements for methane reduction targets. These were, the regulations were adopted by CalRecycle back in November 2020 and became effective as of January 1st, 2022. It's, oh, I went too fast. It's a statewide effort to reduce the emissions of short-lived climate pollutants, most readily methane reduction, and that is to prevent the production of methane in landfills. It requires cities, counties, special districts, all of us, we all have to adopt ordinances or enforceable measures to implement these requirements. Couple meetings ago, we adopted Title VI, Chapter 4, which addresses solid waste. Tonight, we adopted Title VIII amendments to Chapters 8 and Chapters 10, adding some sections for California Green Building Code requirements and water efficient landscape ordinance. We created a water efficient landscape ordinance. We added some requirements from there. And then now we need to adopt a procurement policy regarding diverted or recovered organic waste products, as well as the purchase of recycled content paper and paper products. So that's what we're going to do tonight, is talk about a new policy. Recovered organic waste products, these are products that are made from organic waste diverted from the landfill. So things like compost, mulch, renewable natural gas for fuel, for heat, for electricity, and then electricity from biomass conversion. The city is required to procure an annual amount that is based on population, and it's 0.08 tons per resident, and this is recalculated every 5 years. So they went off of the 2020 census for our calculation, and this can be met through a combination of the various products. You don't have to just use one product. You can combine it to get to your total product goal. Products Also, they need to be procured, so that doesn't mean that the city actually has to purchase the city or that the city has to use them. So we can have agreements with direct service providers where we can contractually designate an entity to meet those procurements for us. So we can have a contract with, you know, a seller that's out there or with, you know, our franchise waste hauler to do that procurement for us. So there are other ways, direct service provider agreements, where it's not just the city going out and purchasing it off of the market. We can get free distribution from contractors where it meets the eligible requirements. And we can, in terms of usage, we can do giveaway events where product can be given away to our residents. Just so that everyone can see what our procurement target is now, this is shows our target calculations. It details what qualifies as a recovered organic waste product and the amount of each product that would be required if we were going to reach our target goal 100% by individual. So you can see here how much renewable gas we would need. So, or I guess I should start with our procurement target is 2,369.8 tons annually. And we can reach that through renewable gas, electricity, heat, compost, and mulch, or any combination thereof. So it's quite a lot. If you look at compost in tonnage would be roughly 1,400 tons, or mulch would be the entire tonnage we'd need to do in mulch to meet our goals. So to really estimate look at how we are going to meet our procurement goals, we have to determine the types of products that are available to us and the amount of each product that would be feasible for both acquisition and use. Transportation fuel, the city itself doesn't have a fleet of vehicles that could use this type of fuel, and there isn't really access to this type of fuel throughout the state. So even if we did have a fleet that was capable of using RNG, we wouldn't right now have the capability of purchasing that type of fuel. Energy from renewable gas, right now we don't have access to heater energy that is created that meets this goal, but there is potential for looking at that procurement later on down the line, you know, after 2024, when the city moves into the Central Coast Community Energy, you know, what they're purchasing and if some of that would apply. There is a potential, if any of that is going on the grid right now with PG&E, with looking at PG&E for that, and then also the HZI down in SLO County, what they do with their anaerobic digester and the energy that's being produced there, where that is going, and if there's any way for the city to tie into that. So there's maybe some potential there, though realistically that would be very, very small compared to what we would need to meet the goal. So we really need to look at something like compost and mulch. The issue with compost and mulch is while our Public Works Department is utilizing a few cubic yards of this annually, the amount that needs to be used is much, much, much larger than what we could potentially ever use in the city on an annual basis. So just sort of as an idea, we sort of looked at what's out there locally in terms of prices and then what other jurisdictions statewide have sort of been estimating, you know, as they've been looking at direct contracts with composting companies and those types who, you know, are receiving the organics and then turning them into compost, what those would look like. And for compost, it's about $10 to $30 per yard. So if the city was going to do straight procurement of that, we'd be anywhere between $34,400 and $105,000 annually to reach our compost procurement target. And for mulch, it's about 20 to 60 per yard, so we'd be looking at 70,000 to about 213,300,000. And then the more fun part of all of that is not only would we need to procure it, but we have to develop a whole program that meets that procurement target and uses the material, which is going to be pretty challenging for us because that target, obviously, of 2,369.8 tons annually far exceeds what we can use here in the city. And on top of that, if, say, we were to go to mulch, you can only use an eligible product. So, you know, we have a lot of tree trimmers in town. And I think we just did it several weeks ago where we did chipping mulch giveaway. That product does not count. It doesn't chip. Something that is chipped on site does not count. It has to be something that is literally, and although that doesn't seem to make sense because it's supposed to be diverted from a landfill, it actually has to come from the landfill. So if we want to procure those types of chips, we need to get those chips from Chicago Grade Landfill or one of the other landfills in town. So that level of procurement doesn't count. So we have to look at eligible products. They have very strict rules for mulch, and in the policy, you'll see that we've put a definition on SB 1383 eligible mulch because the regulations are strict on what type of product counts as eligible mulch. They also have what they consider eligible compost, and so whatever we procure needs to meet those requirements. So while we are using some now, it doesn't necessarily mean that what we're using now currently meets those eligibility requirements. So on a go forward, anything that we procure here in the city that we're using, we need to make sure meets those requirements, and that anyone we contract with to, you know, do any of our projects or any of that type of stuff is also using eligible products. We need to be looking at the capacity for use on managed lands. And so, you know, with partnerships, you know, with things that, like, say, if Alps is doing something at Stadium Park, you know, we need to make sure that any of the product that they're using is this SB 1383 eligible product. Otherwise, we won't get any credit for the use of that. We need to look at capacity and location for storage when it comes to compost and mulch, since these are really the most readily available and already in use for the city. These are the two that we're going to, you know, staff's been looking most towards in order to meet our procurement requirements. But we need to know where we can store, where do we have and how much can we store and where can we store it. We need to look at how we maintain and secure where it's stored. And then the ultimate in use, what's the city going to use? What are we going to do for giveaways? And then whatever type of available partnership opportunities there are, if there's ways that we can partner with Waste Management and Chicago Grade, both locally and statewide in franchise agreement amendments, they've been looking at ways to partner with both those who have agreements with landfills and those who have agreements with franchise haulers to figure out ways to do these partnerships to have help in obtaining this. So whether it's stuff that they get from contractors or, you know, whatnot, that there's a way that they're helping the city to obtain this and reach their procurement targets. Another fun part of this recovered organic waste product procurement is record keeping. So we need to look at not only how much time it takes to procure it, to use it, to apply it, to maintain it, and to give it away, but we also have to look at how much time it takes to keep all of the records. And so if we were, say, to do a direct service provider agreement, our direct service provider would have to keep a whole bunch of records, but we have to keep almost kind of mirrored those, the date we receive the product, how and where we use the product, the type and quality and source of the product, proof of purchase, you know, copy of any enforceable mechanism where we're using mulch, and then a copy of an agreement. And then we have to be very specific in our agreements. You know, we have to define the type of product we're using. We need to have an enforcement mechanism if, you know, for if they don't procure a product that is in line with SB 1383 compliance. So we have a lot of record keeping just for the organic waste side. And I really have no idea how much that would, but based on that and everything, I mean, you're probably looking at, you know, on average 5 to 10 hours annually, I mean, weekly, you know, if I had to guess, once you take it all into consideration, on average, that's where we're going to land with that. And then on the other side of that, regulations also require us to purchase recycled content paper and paper products. So this means our janitorial supplies, our all our types of tissue, all of our paper towels, all of our writing paper, all of our printing paper, our post-it notes, our file folders, our hanging folders, I mean, any stickers, any paper product that you can think of, we are required to look first and foremost for 30% post-consumer recycled material. On top of that, we are also required to look for and purchase products that are eligible to be labeled with an unqualified recyclable label. That basically means not only are we purchasing recycled content paper, but we are purchasing paper products that are then recyclable. And so this unqualified recyclable label is really kind of that thing that you always see, you know, that says this product is recyclable. The regulations require that we get certification from the vendor or the manufacturer that not only to the recyclable content, but that it is also eligible to be labeled with that recyclable symbol. We are allowed to waive certification of the recyclable material percentage if we can find it in the vendor catalog, on the invoice, on the website. So there are ways that we don't have to reach out to a vendor and say, hey, you need to give us written certification. But there isn't a way right now that you can waive the unqualified recyclable content, though CalRecycle has recognized that this may be difficult to obtain. And so while we may not be able to obtain that, we do have to include while we record keep that we weren't able to get it or the vendor wasn't able to provide it or something. So that's an additional step that we need to take when we do this. On top of it, our policy and what's required by the regulations is that fitness and quality of the paper products are equal to the non-recycled. So you have to go for the recycled content where the fitness and quality are equal to non-recycled. And if you choose not to get something that doesn't meet the recycled content, post-consumer content, you have to detail that justification in your record keeping on why you chose something that didn't meet the 30% or more. And we are also giving preference price, and where price is equal or less than the non-recycled, then we will purchase the recycled content. Let's see. Back to record keeping. There's in this city, our purchasing is decentralized, meaning purchasing is done by all of our departments, our divisions, across the board. We do try to do things in bulk, you know, with purchasing janitorial supplies. They try to purchase those in bulk, but you never know when something comes up and you need to buy some. And then we do try with some of our, you know, writing paper and that type to purchase in bulk. But when you're talking fire folders and you're talking post-it notes and you're hanging file folders and stickers and anything like that you can think of, you can't purchase those in bulk because you don't know what the needs are of each department and division. You know, when you're talking colored paper, that type of stuff, there's just no way of buying that in bulk that is economical and cost efficient, because that's sort of just what comes up. So all purchasers, so here's what all purchasers need to do now. They need to research cost, fitness, and recycled content before they make the purchase. They need to document each product purchased. And when I mean that, I mean you need to put, if you purchased 50 Post-it notes, then on the spreadsheet, you need to put 50 postage notes. So if you made a big order and you ordered 3 boxes of file folders and it was 100 file folders per box, you have to detail that. You have to say, you know, 3 boxes, 100 per box. So you've got to document each product purchased. And then, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, any justification for why the product purchased did not meet the requirements. You have to upload, so every purchaser will need to upload this documentation within 30 days of purchase. And then also when we're out there having things printed like the roads brochure, we need to request that our vendors use best efforts to meet the recycled content requirements. Again, don't know what this will look like, but based on the number of purchasers and the products that are purchased citywide, probably a good another 5 to 10 hours weekly in record keeping. And that will also include just regular record keeping. So overarching, we need to have someone who's tracking all of that and making sure that our spreadsheets are getting uploaded regularly, that all of the work that's being done and all of the procurement that's being done is being collated, is being collected, collated, and maintained, and then ultimately provided to IWMA. It has to be, it's required to be collected and maintained as part of the implementation record. IWMA is the one who does the reporting to CalRecycle on the city's behalf, but we need to provide them that information. And so they do reach out monthly to see where we're at so that they can kind of keep a running sort of tab too. And while paper purchases isn't what you have to report to CalRecycle, CalRecycle has pretty much said, listen, if we call and ask for it, we expect you to provide it forthwith. So in keeping it, you know, regularly updated and together means that if CalRecycle calls, we have it and we can immediately provide it. So it's just a lot more intensive effort and, you know, additional staff time and burden on staff to meet these requirements. I kind of went over it a little bit, but just to sort of put it in perspective, annual, just the organic waste products purchase, if the city has to go it alone and we don't have ways to find how to get some of this donated, whether it be by contractors or, you know, in agreements, we're looking at $34,400 to $213,300 annually, because that's what it would cost us to meet our procurement target annually. And then again, like I said, 10 to 20 hours weekly of staff time. And that's just all of the purchase and record keeping requirements. It's the procurement, the storage, the application, the giveaways, and then all the record keeping on top of that for your organic waste, and then our overall tracking. Hard to recommend, but I need you to please adopt a draft resolution amending the purchasing policy to add Section X, which will create policies and procedures for the purpose of recovered organic waste products as required by Senate Bill 1383. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Folks, if you didn't hear it here, you wouldn't believe it, and you may still not believe it after listening to all of that. It is something that we are required to adopt, and so, you know, we can ask a few questions. I don't think we need to delve into a lot of detail. It is what it is, and my hope is that some sense prevails at some point, and we'll see if that's the case. With that, I will look to my council members to see if there are any questions on this item. I can kind of see you on the, okay, Councilmember Darris. You got to know where your camera is so I can see your hand.
Okay, just a couple questions on the fiscal impact here. You know, that's obviously a huge range, 34,213. The first question is, I think I understand that that range is just for the procurement of, like, the mulch and compost and whatnot.
Yes, because right now we don't have access to procurement for any of the RNG fuel or right. energy. So we're looking just at least for right now what it would cost for mulch and compost.
Okay, so that cost, I mean, that cost is just for that aspect of it. So there's obviously an additional cost for the 10 to 20 hours per week. That's not really, I guess it's not listed or mentioned as a fiscal impact. And then the question I have also with the, what's it called, the recycled content paper, is there a significant cost difference between that type of paper versus what you might ordinarily buy without thinking about it?
There can be, which is why we've written it, that the cost for that needs to be equal or less than before we'll make that force to purchase that. Some say, you know, it varies statewide. Some have given a percentage, you know, if it's not more than 5%, 10%, 15%. So some have built that in. But for us, because we do keep a tight budget and walk a pretty tight line when it comes to our expenditures, have done it that it needs to be equal or less than.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Councilmember Funk.
I mute myself with this technology. Is there an option for agricultural uses of the compost and mulch? I mean, and does it have to be inside the city? And that's a big, ag land can absorb quite a lot of the compost and mulch very efficiently.
So it needs to meet the procurement target of the city. So the city would still need to be the one procuring it, or it would need to be procured on behalf of the city. So we don't have to be the ones that use it, but it would have to be procured on our behalf. So, you know, there's a lot to work out in a program like that. How does that work in terms of if ag lands are doing that, how does that balance out in terms of the program and what's considered the procurement? You know, is someone procuring it on behalf of the city and then donating it to AgLand? Is that a cost to the city, a cost to residents? You know, those are things that all sort of have to play out as we move further through this program.
Yeah. Okay. And does the record keeping, if we do giveaways like we did with the chipped mulch, does the record keeping extend to the person whose pickup truck is being filled with mulch needing to specify exactly what property it's used on or how it's used?
No. So what we would say is that it was a giveaway to, you know, it was a residential giveaway on this date, and this is how much was done in that residential giveaway.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Councilmember Borbo.
Although, as you pointed out, our current mulch giveaway doesn't count because that mulch never entered the system. You know, it never entered the landfill or entered the system, so giving it away doesn't count, even though it's precisely what they want us to do, right? But in the sense that, you know, you got to buy 2,000 tons of compost or mulch or something, and essentially you could give it away in the city, but as Councilmember Funk alluded to, there might be use in agriculture. Could you, in theory, buy, you know, that, let's say, for $20 a ton and then sell it to an agricultural use for $10 a ton just to get it off your hands and save a little bit of money?
I don't think they anticipated that, which would be a good question for CalRecycle, but I don't know that they anticipated it being a procure and then turn around and sell. It was more, you know, the point of it, I guess I should have pointed this out earlier too, it doesn't also have to be procured locally. So we can, and if we needed to procure from, you know, outside of the area, if there's someplace else where there's a large production of mulch and compost, there's also ways, you know, if we go further down this program where we can, you know, put things, requirements for, you know, new development, that type of stuff that would work towards the procurement target. But, you know, those are all things right. that we have to look at as we move forward. I don't know that they envisioned city okay. purchasing and then in the turning around and selling. So,
but they did visualize us obtaining it paying for it and giving it away to our own residents.
They did, yes.
So, I mean, in theory, any one of these categories, I mean, and it sounds like you could go to another state, buy renewable gas at, let's say, $20 a unit and sell it for 10, just to meet the requirement and save a little bit of money.
Yeah, so even with the gas, it has to meet their specific requirements.
I understand.
So
it has to qualify.
So I'm not sure. I mean, okay. If outside, the point was to be taking our organic waste in the state of California and turning that back into energy. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, as bad and as silly as this is for us, can you imagine a highly urban community like San Francisco trying to, buy and dispose of, 100,000 tons of compost and mulch? They've got no place to do it. They'll have to give it away to the valley or something. So my question is, though, I assume, we're tracking what other agencies throughout the state, because everybody's trying to figure this out, and somebody might come up with a good solution, and I assume that either through some forum, we're looking beyond Slo County as to, hey, maybe somebody's figured out a good way to do this. Okay.
Yeah, I've been looking across the state and been participating in, league roundtables and that type of stuff on this topic and what others are doing. And I think I'll point out, too, that I think what was envisioned by CalRecycle and what there's been a lot of talk of is that this is going to prompt the creation of many, 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 many more digesters, and that will then, increase the amount of energy that's being produced. That'll then, provide everybody to meet their procurement targets via the energy, which I think is what they're kind of really hoping to see.
Sure. I think I saw a slide that we'd need like 50 to 100 more digesters in California to do that. And, of course, try building something like that anywhere in California. It'll take you numerous years. Now, the other thing is, though, speaking of working, and you mentioned Cal Cities, the League of Cities, these extremely onerous and highly detailed requirements are in the regulations written by CalRecycle to implement SB 1383. They're not in SB 1383 itself, right? So this is a regulatory overkill by a regulatory body as opposed to, let's say, a lesser level of overkill by the legislature compounded by, a regulatory agency. So that is something I hope that we work with Cal Cities to perhaps get them to rein in CalRecycle's being onerous. My last question is, because as silly as the whole stuff is about the mulch and all that kind of stuff, is the paperwork requirements for the paper. I mean, you're going to spend more time and money keeping track of where you bought your paper and what kind of paper you bought than you are on the paper. So my question is this, if we're supposed to procure paper this way and document and everything. If somebody gave you paper, if somebody donated all the sticky notes the city ever needed to use, would that relieve you, because it's not a city procurement then, would that relieve you of having to keep track of all of that, let's say, for sticky notes?
I'd argue yes, because we didn't purchase it.
Okay.
And I mean, what the regulations say is that anything we purchase, so.
Right. That's why I ask, because, I mean, so in theory, and do you have any idea how much money we spend on paper, whether it's just regular paper or sticky notes or, colored paper for brochures?
If we could just kind of, we've got to adopt a policy.
No, I understand. I just want to understand
I'd say no, because it's actually just, supplies, and so everything falls under there. We've never tracked just paper or post-it notes or, we've never tracked it that.
Right. I'm in all types of paper. But all right. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to ask, are you want to address us as staff or public comment?
Staff.
All right. We've got our staff member, Ryan Betts, who would like to.
This is on?
There we go.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, City Council. My name is Ryan Betts. I'm the Public Works Analyst, and I've been working with the City Manager's Office since I've started here on this exact topic. I think a lot of questions that the Council has raised in terms of procurement of the organic waste, that mulch, that compost, all those things that Council has raised, I want to bring a little bit of good news in this topic, and I hope it's good news, is the city has partnered with IWMA to apply for a grant with CalRecycle for an individual through SB 1383 to do some capacity planning for that procurement. That includes storage of that material, the transportation of that material, and certainly what Councilmember Funk talked about, kind of that connection or that partnership with maybe some agricultural industries and whatnot, to see what that would look like and feel like. We will get that the results of that that grant application around early April. We're hopeful for that, to be awarded that grant. It's going to be around $39,000, $40,000 to do that capacity planning. It's going to do a lot more than what I'm listing tonight, but we're hoping to have a lot of those questions answered through that grant application. And so we're really looking forward to that. We think we have a really good shot at getting that. Those capacity planning will answer, again, a lot of those questions, because we certainly have a lot of concerns, obviously, of the storage, the transportation, and how we actually roll out this program. The other thing I'll note is every city, as Laura mentioned, county, special district, is using this or seeing these types of regulations as well. And so that demand may not be as much as we think, because certainly our neighbors to the north and south are going to be looking to do the same type of partnerships with some of our agricultural industries. So that's another challenge that we are well aware of and we'll have to work through. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I had the same thought, that we might actually have to pay to give it away. So it could cost even more. All right. As I said, we're talking a policy tonight that we need to adopt. And so we don't want to get bogged down in any details here. There are more questions that will be asked and answered as this is implemented. So with that, I'd like to open us up to public comment and see if there are any public members of the public that would wish to speak on this item. Go ahead and come to the podium. And if you are in the webinar, go ahead and raise your hand. Good evening.
Test.
I think you're still turned off.
It's green.
There you go.
Okay. Good evening, Council. Once again, Jeff Hossen. I have a couple concerns, and maybe we can push this back a little bit, as well as you have to adopt this, but maybe some questions can be pushed back on CalRecycle. One is, if we're giving this away free to residents, and you fill up a pickup truck and you have no idea how much you need, you might need half that pickup truck. So the two concerns are that somebody in a residential area with curb and sidewalk is now using too much mulch or compost in their front yard, and it ends up in the storm drains, which we spent a lot of time here at Council talking about how we can't have things in storm drains. Also, it's supposed to put down so you're not having as much weeds, if you will, so you have less of a fire danger. However, if you're using too much, you could have a fire danger. So I think these are things that we should be pushing back with based on the rural area in which we live. Thank you.
Thank you. I will go ahead and look to the webinar to see if there are any hands raised. Luke, I'm going to ask you, there we go. I've got the audience up now. Anybody, any of our attendees who are wishing to speak on this item, please go ahead and raise your hand. Or if you are on the phone, go ahead and press *9. All right, we're not seeing anyone on the phone or in the webinar. So I will go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to Council. Yes, those are all questions and things we will be asking. I think, as Councilmember Morbeau said, you know, working with the League of Cities, and how do we bring some logic to this to make sure that, I mean, in the implementation, as you indicated, this being a more of a CalRecycle bureaucratic huge layer that is really, I mean, could take the equivalent of a half-time employee at the city, which is really mind-boggling for what we're talking about. So hopefully, as Mr. Betts said, there could be some grant opportunities to help with some streamlining or figuring this out that it can work better. and with maybe the league and banding together with other cities to say, to do some pushback and say, hey, this is some overkill. We understand the intent of this, and you know, how can we relieve some of the burden, because we cannot be the only city feeling this burden. With that, I would look to my council members. I'm loath to ask for a motion for this policy.
I'll make the motion.
I'll second.
We have a motion by council member Darris, a second by Mayor Pro Tem Newsom. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Councilmember Borbo?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. We will move on to number three of our management reports, which is the General Plan and Housing Element Annual Progress Report for 2021. And this will be our Community Development Director, Mr. Phil Densmore.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, Council. Let me just get my screen up here. I've got a few numbers to show you. This is our annual report that we do every year, where we report out to the State Department of Housing and Community Development and tell us sort of the production of the numbers of housing units we've got each year. We also give you a quick update on what projects might be coming. Let me see if I can get this screen to work here. I don't see this on here. Just a moment. Luke, I wonder if I could bother you just for a second, just to see why this is not in my selection. I've got this that I want to share. It's strange. I had too many windows open working on a variety of projects, so it'll be a little while to find that. Here we go. Let's see if it comes up on the screen. And the good thing is I don't have to ask you if you can see my screen, because I can see the screen as well. But if it comes up, we'll see. Technical difficulties. Just a moment. Stop sharing. I have to minimize that, don't I? Sorry for the delay. We're back online. We're going. All right. A little bit of a glitch in the system there. I always like to give a background. This is another state requirement. Essentially, what the state requires us that we do is we kind of tell them how we're doing with our housing element policies. We tell them how we're doing with our RENA numbers, which is our regional housing needs allocation for our area. And we have to give the state generally an overview of our activities. After tonight's hearing, after we look at these numbers, we actually have to submit a very thorough report to HCD. And each year, it seems to have gotten longer and longer and longer. This year, it includes a lot of different categories. There's a lot of monitoring. And they're really looking into how each city is performing in terms of meeting all of their general plan housing element goals and objectives, and that we're doing what we said we'd do by making properties available, by making housing units available. Now, we can't force housing to be built, I'll say that, but what we can do is we can create policies that enable housing, we can create zoning that enables housing, and we can take away barriers for creating housing. That's what the state really wants us to do. So let's look at the raw numbers. I will apologize in advance. There was a little error. There was a little transposition of some numbers in the chart that you saw in your staff report. This one should be correct. It shows all of the categories, extremely low, low, moderate, market rate, and our total. What I will tell you, which is really interesting, for 2021, our city produced a lot of housing units, 136 units, you can see in your far right column, compared to 2020, where 45 were completed. I'll also tell you, it takes a couple years for these numbers to come to fruition. So the numbers that we see in 2021 were being planned in 2018 and 2019, which was a banner year for a lot of things happening. It takes, you know, a year for a house to be planned. It takes another year for it to be constructed, and then several more months for it to actually be final. So the numbers you see there are actual units that got completed, built, occupied. Now, the numbers in the categories for low and very low, those are hard units to accomplish. Those categories are always a bit low. But what I will tell you is there's a lot of projects in the pipeline that, given the fact that we're in the very beginning of an 8-year cycle for our arena, we're actually doing quite well. I expect that we, as you can see already, far exceeded our market rate and our moderate numbers are cruising along pretty well. So in terms of, if we look at 8 years of, you know, 136 units, we'll be doing great. So our balances are looking pretty good. Now, the new thing this year that's really interesting is the state allows us to include accessory dwelling units. They also allowed us to include units that are generally what we call affordable by design, as long as we can demonstrate through a market study that those units are small enough and are actually renting for those levels. Now, typically what we get, it's pretty easy to get the moderate level, because the moderate affordability levels in our community are pretty close to what the market rate is anyway. So we're doing pretty well there. And what we expect to see is a continued increase in accessory dwelling units as we do things like our pre-designed stock plans, which we'll have available later this year in the project that we're sharing with multiple other communities. And so we'll have those available. I also understand now there's grants available, not through the city, but privately, to help develop accessory dwelling units. That, in combination with the dramatically reduced or even exempt development impact fees, huge incentive for those accessory units. So we're starting to really see those come in at a much greater magnitude now. So as I was alluding to, some of the projects on the horizon, some of the projects that have already come to us and gone through the approval process, and those that are still kind of going through the approval process, include up to 1,000 housing units. And a couple hundred of those that could end up in the low and very low income categories. Del Rio Ridge, that's a project that's being developed by People Self-Help Housing near Del Rio. That's going to have 40 low and very low units. They're still waiting and competing for grant funding on that project, but it's likely to move forward. 10850 El Camino Real, that's actually formerly known as the Hartburg project. It's actually under construction right now. It'll have 75 units. It's a mixture of townhomes, and in the rear of that site, it's actually a senior housing project. And so that's where that bigger number comes from. Principal project, it's expected to start this year, next year. They're actually working on all of their construction permits, getting very close to starting. 52 units, several of those units will be also designated as affordable. Del Rio Ranch, that's the project that we looked at the former Walmart site. It actually has up to 80 residential units. Nothing that's going to be deed restricted affordable yet, as far as we know, but that housing project is yet to come to us. We just know what the zoning can occupy up there and the fact that they are working on some plans for that. Barrel Creek, that project hasn't come to you yet. It will be coming to you. We're working with that applicant team right now. They will have some single-family units in there, and they'll also be proposing some multifamily units in that property. Could be up to 80. Likely to be a few less, but quite a few in that project. And since that project does entail a rezoning, we can also enact our interim affordable housing policy and require some affordability in that particular project. And then there's Emerald Ridge, which you've seen the first phase of that. There's actually 172 left. None of those in the affordable categories. Some of them might end up in the moderate category just by default, by design. But it is a really high-quality, nice project. A lot more units coming there. And then recently, through our design review committee, we've looked at several what we call by right projects. And these are projects that are in the high density residential zones. They're modifications and amendments to existing projects. One of those, a Macadero apartment project, where they want to deed restrict those existing units and build an additional units. the Empire Apartments project. It's near Ardea Road. They want to do a very similar thing there, double the density of those units, build upstairs. And then California Manor, they're proposing to do a whole nother addition to that property. All three of those are proposed to be low and very low deed-restricted units, more than 200 when you combine the three of them. They've all come through a review process through our design review committee. They don't require any further approval other than construction permits, but all three of those are seeking funding through tax credit programs and seeking contributions from either our community or other sources so they can grade higher on those tax credit programs. So we'll see if those actually come to fruition. But if all of these come to fruition, we're going to get pretty darn close for our arena for our eight-year cycle. It's going to be looking pretty good. We'll definitely exceed our moderate and our above-moderate levels, and we'll make a good dent in the low and very low. So things are looking good for long term. We'll just see how those things fold out and see what the economy keeps going as the interest rates start to kick up and hopefully the construction material costs go down. But with that, I'd like to summarize and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Director. And this is a receive and file for us tonight. But to let the public know, this is a sixth cycle of what's considered the ARENA. ARENA is the Regional Housing Needs Allocation. And so the state says to each of the counties, here are the number of units that you need to basically zone for, make available for someone to come in and build. And then at the county level, it gets allocated between the cities and the county properties. And so as you can see here, we're looking at 843 for Atascadero during this eight-year sixth cycle. And we are not required to make sure that these are built, although we're being pushed more in that direction. But of course, we want them to be built. And so we provide those incentives. We certainly make the zoning appropriate as it needs to be and look at other policies and how we can help to facilitate this to happen. And so this has been a good update, and we can see that our community and what we've been able to accomplish is looking pretty good here. So let's any questions that we have on the report before we receive and file? Councilmember Funk.
Thank you. And thank you for the report, Director Dunsmore. This is a really important thing for us to continue to be working on and incentivizing, particularly at the lower ends where really these units don't happen without a lot of intentionality and a lot of subsidy for the low and the very low. But it is the pathway forward to our being able to create an environment where people who work here can live here, and people who live here can work here, and nobody has to live in the creek. So with that in mind, the two Haslow projects that are part of this, Macadero and Empire, as I recall, those are both listed in the report as being only low but not any very low units. Is there any chance of some of those coming through to give us some more of the very low units?
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure if there wasn't some very low in those projects. I don't recall, and I don't know that we have the discretion to ask for that in those particular instances.
Okay, I'll talk with Haslow about that. And I noticed that in the lovely spreadsheet here on page 214 of our packet that we have a number of projects listed as approved. Some of those I recognize having been through design review committee, but also what about Barrel Creek?
I think we're getting a bit ambitious with that column. Oh. The column automatically defaulted to approved. They are not approved. So apologize for that. It's strange how there's a check button in there. I went to go look at it, and it flipped over. So those are not approved. So Barrel Creek has not gone through a review process yet and still needs our endorsement.
Right. And I also wanted to point something out that I was noticing and check and see if that's consistent with your experience, that I did this on page 218 of the packet. One of the concerns that we had coming up with our ADUs is that previously, before we changed some of the incentives for ADUs, that almost all of the applications for ADUs, granny units, granny flats, that kind of thing, we're coming in at the 1,200 square foot level, and it's hard for people to to keep those at an affordable level. So the smaller ADUs are the ones where your kid or somebody else's kid can get a place to stay, so that there's room in the apartments for other people, so that eventually we can get people out of the creek and have places that they can live. Without you necessarily having that directly. And I do see that quite a lot of these units are in the 400 to 750 square foot category, as opposed to just four of them that are in the near 1,200. So it looks like those incentives are working. Is that your assessment of this?
Yes. The change in the development impact fee structure has had a resounding effect on encouraging the smaller, affordable by design units, which has enabled us to put more of them into the affordable category towards our arena, which is fantastic. And we feel that the development of the stock plans will continue to generate that, because those stock plans are also of these smaller units. Because since we're working with several other communities, those communities demanded the smaller units. We still have a 1,000-square-foot one in there, but generally they're smaller designs. And we're seeing demand for units down to even 250, 300, 400 square feet. We're not doing stock plans that small. We're doing something around 450, I think. But generally, those are the unit sizes where we can justify affordability by design, and possibly even reaching, in some cases, that low-income category.
Excellent. That's the housing for the next generation right there. How are those stock plans coming along? I've been very excited about what we've seen in design review committee that Mayor Pro Tem Newsom and I have looked at.
So I think we're done with our design review process, so now working on the final version of those plans, and we hope to see the results of that soon.
So sometime in the next few months, maybe, the people who are thinking about should they put an ADU on their property would be able to come and look at a set of plans that they could pick from a menu and move through very quickly. That's basically the idea?
That's the idea. We'll have a catalog. You can come to the counter and you can order your pre-approved plan for a special price. We're going to give a great deal on those. They're free. So it's going to be a nice incentive, and nice that we can have a part in kind of assisting with that design as well.
Okay. That concludes my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And seeing no other questions, and thank you, Mr. Dunsworth, for taking the lead on that countywide. It was nice that Atascadero got to take the lead on that project. We'll go ahead and open up to public comment on this item. Again, it's a receive and file. It's a progress report on what's going on, all the hard work that staff has done over the last year and a half or so, and that you as a community have participated in with us in making these decisions. And now we're seeing the fruits of our labor. So we have nobody in person. I'll look to the webinar. If you want to go ahead and raise your hand, if you're on the phone, please press *9. I'm seeing people there, but nobody has questions or comments. Luke, anyone on the phone? No. Okay. Well, I will go ahead and close public comment, and thank you very much, Director, for your report. We'll go ahead now and move on to council announcements and reports. I will go from my left to my right and start with Councilmember Darris.
Oops. Thank you. I don't really have anything to report other than to say that I did attend the RTA's open house for their new facility in San Luis Obispo. It's a really nice-looking facility. Nice to see that done, and I think it's in a great location. It's highly visible from the highway. And I think that's fantastic. So it was great to see that done, and congratulations to them and everybody involved.
Councilmember Borbo.
Thank you. Yes, at the last Integrated Waste Management Authority IWMA board meeting, the board did unanimously pass the rate increase necessitated by implement all the requirements 1383, where the IWMA will assist the jurisdictions, the cities and the special districts in implementing 1383, which, as we've just heard over and over again, is a very costly endeavor. So that rate increase will be making its through as haulers negotiate rate increases with their jurisdictions, including our hauler, Waste Management. Secondly, the board voted 6-1 to approve the amendment to the Joint Powers Agreement. That was necessitated partly by the county's departure, but also to include some other items requested by various jurisdictions. That one was Pismo Beach. Their representative voted no. One of the changes in the JPA was to allow for a second seat for the special districts, that is the CSDs, based on them representing more population than even our largest city in the county. But that was an expressed concern by the representative from Pismo Beach, and I am understanding that that is maybe shared by others in Pismo Beach, not just their representative. So it is the considered judgment that Pismo Beach should be the first jurisdiction to review the JPA amendment and see what they do with it before having other jurisdictions such as ourselves review it, because it does require unanimous consent of all the cities for the JPA amendment to go into effect. And so if that's not achieved, or if there's a condition attached, it would be good to know about the condition before we and other cities consider that. So that's where that's at. That's, a fly in the ointment. But we'll see where that goes from here, and we'll address that as necessary.
When do you expect that to go before the Pismo City Council?
I do not know precisely. I would gather, I'm not sure if Pismo is meets like us on the second and fourth Tuesday or the first and third Tuesday of the month. So I would expect, that it would go to them. If their first meeting in April is real soon, it probably wouldn't happen. It would probably be their second meeting in April. So I would say, the second or third or fourth week.
So 2 to 4 weeks away.
Yeah, okay. Right, correct.
I also am curious because something that obviously that all the cities, when we move forward with it, and something we talked about also at the mayor's meeting quite a lot, was the desire that everything would remain. Anything that IWMI put into place would be nothing beyond what is the requirement from, that comes from the state. So does the agreement hold to that, or is there anything in there that would be cause for concern?
The new language in the draft agreement or draft joint powers agreement contains a specific clause that says that the IWMA, in adopting any future ordinances, would only adopt ordinances that are mandated by state law, or state garbage-related legislation. It has a subsequent sentence that says that, notwithstanding that provision, that any existing ordinance of the IWMA would remain in effect. So in relationship to the controversial polystyrene ordinance that was adopted in 2019, suspended in 2020, and the board voted 7-5 to repeal it, but there was a provision requiring 8 votes for an action, so the polystyrene ordinance was not repealed, and so it is on the books. There was a consensus through the process, because realizing that a majority of the city representatives did not vote to repeal. I did vote to repeal the ordinance. But a majority of the cities did not, and the representative from Paso Robles, who was very strong about not wanting the ordinance first place, was accepting of, allowing it to stay on the books just to ensure that no further ordinances be adopted that were not required by state legislation. So to the extent that that might be an issue of concern, I think that'll be interesting to see how that plays out before the different councils. Keeping in mind that, a majority of those cities, of the 7 cities, their representatives voted not to repeal the ordinance, and some felt pretty strongly about it. So this could be an issue that, it becomes a bone of contention as we go through this ratification process.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
City Schools Committee, along with my colleague Charles Barbeau, are going to meet for the first time in the last, 18 months, Friday at 10. So if anybody has anything additional that they'd like us to address, the agenda has been posted. We will be meeting at the school district office. Design Review Committee has been canceled for this coming week, so Nothing more to report.
Thank you. Councilmember Funk.
Yes, thank you. And I have a couple of more substantive updates from our HSOC meeting, Homeless Services Oversight Council, last week. One of them is we had a review of the Kansas Avenue Safe Parking Project. This was started by the county as a pilot project, and they thought they would do it for just a few months and maybe have 20, 30 cars there and get some folks out of Los Osos and some other areas who are living in their vehicles into a setting where they can sleep overnight, not be hassled by the police, and have access to bathrooms and trash. It has evolved into something much larger than that. They can handle up to 90 people now, and it has been running full. They have 60 slots for residential vehicles, and they have a waiting list. So they're going to get a couple open spots. They're going to pull people in from that, managing the extra vehicles that people have so that they're not commuting in their RVs is a bit of a challenge. And they've been working gradually to pull together the supportive services that that environment needs to be a more of a sustaining community, since people are actually around 24/7. A lot of the people who are there work, and some of them are not. So they are commuting back and forth to their jobs, and there's an effort to bring a CAPSLO has been hired, or contracted to provide some services, but they haven't been able to staff that yet. So all kinds of other things that the community is rising up to be constructive, including Cal Poly vet students who came out and did a vet clinic for all the pets. The food bank is concerned about nutritional value there because of the lack of access to cooked food, and they're trying to get more clarity before they put a pantry there. And we're learning from this process what might be done at other safe parking sites that are being considered in other communities. The county's original plan was to do 3 such sites this year. So that's the safe parking update. Another brief issue that came up unexpectedly in public comment was a concern that the county public health department is canceling the program where they have provided hotel vouchers and support for people who are homeless who get COVID and who have to go somewhere, so that they're not sharing that disease with their encamped communities or sharing that disease with people at shelters. So the county is, Joe Dzwonik, who's the county homeless manager working in the county administrator's office, is stepping in to try to keep the FEMA trailers around as a first line of defense and do some other planning for how we can manage this when the inevitable next wave of Omicron 3 or whatever it is, whether it's COVID or something else, communicable disease will be a challenge for folks who are unhoused. So they're trying to do planning for that, and so rapid follow-up is occurring on that issue. And then the big thing that we went over was the presentation from our steering committee working on the strategic plan to address homelessness countywide, because we're not the only city that is dealing with this. Every community is. And so I would plan under individual determination at our next council meeting to give this council a bigger presentation so that you get a chance to see where the steering committee is going with the strategic plan and get to give some feedback by giving guidance to me as your representative on HSOC about how you want things to evolve in that process. Yeah. Got to get something here for all the work I do on this. So I get a little early peek and a chance to weigh in. So that will be coming up in 3 weeks from tonight. Thank you. And thank you for indulging a little longer rundown on this.
Sure thing. And thank you for the work you're doing on HSOC, and we'll look forward to that presentation next time around. And I think you're bringing that to the mayor's meeting as well, right? Yes. So I'll get to see it twice. All right. I know. Lucky me. As far as anything, yes, I was with Councilmember Darris at the bus maintenance facility, which was pretty fantastic. I'll reiterate, on time and under budget, a huge part of the funding. It was a $26 million project, and a big part of that funding was a TIFIA loan, which stands for Transit Infrastructure Financing. You know, it's a long acronym from the federal government, and we were the first rural area to get that. It is a 35-year loan and just under 0.7% interest. So it's really, as Councilmember Darris said, a fantastic facility. And then when you look at the financing of it and everything that came together, what a benefit to our entire community. So yay on that. We had at the mayor's meeting a presentation from Tom Habashi from 3CE, the CEO of 3CE, very smart man. And, you know, we shared a lot about what we all know is that as California continues moving towards electrification, that, you know, in the next few years, we're going to have some problems, particularly after the second reactor shuts down from Diablo, let's say, come summer of 2026. It's, you know, we have some concerns, and certainly 3C and others are doing what they can in terms of battery storage. But I don't know that anybody sees a real answer on the horizon for how are we going to be handling that. And I think just what I see concerning is that California continues to push further electrification rather than pausing and saying, hey, let's get the grid secure and do what we need to do to make sure that we can move forward safely. But instead, we keep pushing that and incentivizing that. So it will be interesting to see. It's the best word I can come up with. Interesting to see how that turns out over the next few years. But I know many of us are concerned about that. So that is all from my committee reports. And I will ask if we have any individual determinations or actions. I am seeing none. So we will go ahead and recess our regular meeting and go into closed session. If you would like to speak by phone or in the webinar on a closed session item, or if anyone were here in person, please stick around for a moment. I'm going to ask our city attorney to let us know what is being discussed.
Yes, this will be a conference with real property negotiators. It's Government Code Section 54956.8. It's real property located at 6009 Del Rio Road. The APN numbers are in the agenda. Other properties are 2000 Ramona Road, 6105 Olmeda Avenue, and the owners that are under negotiations are the State of California. And the agency negotiator is the city manager. And the subject of negotiations are purchase price in terms of payment.
Thank you, Mr. Perrick. So we'll go ahead and open up public comment. And if there's anyone in the webinar, go ahead and raise your hand. If there's anyone on the phone that would wish to speak to this item, press star 9. I'm seeing none. We'll close public comment. We'll go into closed session, and we will report out at our next regularly scheduled council meeting as to whether there's a reportable action. So good night. We'll see you all in April.